Okay.
Project Zion Podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a wide variety of guests and panelists with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, I'm Seth Bryant, and this is Project Zion, and I am joined tonight by several incredible guests who are actually staying in our home. That was the music of Daniel Harmon, and I'm just so glad that I had my guitar and we could sit down and record it. So, and my wife Jen's joined. Jen, why don't you start out? Say something.
Hi, my name's Jen.
Hi. You want to go around the couch here and just introduce yourselves, tell us your first name and where you're from and why you're here, I guess?
I'm Daniel Harmon. I guess that's more than my first name, but I'm from Claremont, California. I'm here to run a marathon tomorrow in Park City.
And I'm Emily. I'm Daniel's wife. And I'm here to cheer Daniel on and not to run in the marathon.
I'm Lee. I'm also one of the cheerleaders this weekend. I am currently living in Yorba Linda, California, from Overland Park, Kansas.
I'm Aaron. I am running with Daniel from Yorba Linda, California.
Great. So they're running tomorrow morning, spending the night at our place, and I thought, why not break out the recording equipment? And I think the real big question that our listeners want to know about is what it's like to grow up in Community of Christ. So, most, maybe many of our listeners come from an LDS background, and I think they have no idea about things like campfire dates and taking youth caravans in Graceland. Yeah, let's talk. Let's start with, you want to start with youth caravan?
Sure. When I was in high school, I guess, is when we went on our historic caravan, and my dad was the one that took us around. There were lots of other staff people, but he was the main director guy. And we went to all of the church historic sites. We started in Alabama because that's where I grew up, and we went up to Independence to headquarters and saw the temple there. And then we went up to Graceland, and then we did a lot of smaller sites too. So we stopped at Hans Mill Creek and the Liberty Jail and went all the way up to upstate New York. It was really fun.
So what was that like as a group of Community of Christ youth going to LDS? I mean, basically visitor centers, historic sites. Like, how are you received? Do they understand your background, where you're coming from? Are there, like, awkward moments?
Yeah, I don't guess we went to a whole lot of sites that were specifically LDS sites. So, like, in Nauvoo, we stayed on the Community of Christ side. So we stayed in the Nauvoo house. We did go to the other side of town, I guess. There's like a divide over who owns which side of Nauvoo. We were received pretty well. I do have a funny story. I don't know if I want to tell it or not. We went to the pageant at Hill Cumorah, and we had met up with a bunch of other Community of Christ youth groups that were also on caravan, just going in different directions, but we all happened to be at the pageant that night, and so we all sat together, and I just remember it being this really big group, and it was like this really sweet, kind of somber, respectful spirit that is going on before this play happens. And I went with my friend to go and get some water or something, and we came back, and we didn't really know how we were going to find where our seats were because it was just a really big crowd. And my dad stood up and he yells, "If you're from Community of Christ, stand up and go bleh!" And I was like, "Well, there's us." So I don't know if we weren't like received well for that, but you could definitely tell that our tone was maybe a little bit different.
Not as somber.
Yeah, well, I guess we just didn't quite read the crowd as well.
Well, there's this assumption among Mormons that if you clap or make noise, that somehow that's going to drive the spirit away. And I remember one time on my mission, we were at state conference, and we had a guest play I think it was on piano. They played something incredible. And we had a couple seekers, we call them investigators, within the Mormon Church. We had a couple investigators who were there, and they were stunned that there's hundreds of people at the state conference, and nobody claps after this really incredible piano performance. And so they just start clapping as hard as they can because everybody else is being rude, right? And the more that, like, everybody is horrified that they're clapping in the middle of the state conference, they're just clapping even harder.
Well, you guys, I noticed a lot of congregations clap for baptism. So people
baptized. That's an exciting thing.
Which we never would do in the LDS Church.
And there's been kind of this natural, I don't think it's named, but this evolution of clapping in Community of Christ.
That's
so
true.
We have a large event at Graceland University in Lamoni, Iowa that's called Spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And we've reached a place where our youth literally clap after everything. in worship services. So somebody shares like a heartfelt testimony about the struggles of their life and then, "Ooh, that's my boy!" It seems a little out of place. So there's certainly something to be said for reverence and creating that softer spirit. There's a lot of value in that. We seem to be losing some of that in Community of Christ, not in the larger body, but in certain places. We need to, I think,
it's something to cultivate again, I think, for sure.
Yeah. Well, one thing we like to point out in Salt Lake when we clap at a baptism, it says in the Book of Mormon that they clapped at the Waters of Mormon when baptisms took place.
Nice.
So, yeah, finding the right balance, I guess.
Yeah. Sure.
So Emily, as you were there at the Hilcomora pageant, you had mentioned earlier about the pamphlets. You want to tell us about that?
You keep making me tell all these stories. Okay, so another story was, I guess, the characters you play in the pageant, before the actual play starts, they come out and, like, talk to people, and they're sharing materials about Mormonism. And so kids from our group were like, "That's cool. Why don't we give you some of our materials?" Which didn't go over well with some of the characters. And we distinctly remember Emma Smith coming to tell us to shut it down.
Which is really ironic because she joined the reorganization.
Emma wasn't having it.
when we were out in Nauvoo, we got a chance to meet the characters. And my favorite, I always wanted to go shake the hand of Joseph Smith III.
Nice.
And usually it's like 11-year-old boy. He has no idea what's going on, like why I have any interest in him.
Oh, no. Oh, that's funny.
So what's it like growing up Community of Christ when everybody knows Mormonism, they know what the LDS Church is, and you're Community of Christ, and you try to explain that to friends, or maybe if you ever dated somebody who wasn't a member of the church, trying to explain to them, to their parents, what Community of Christ is, you know, in contrast to the larger church within the Restoration.
I think it initially starts out with, most people are familiar with LDS. They know what Mormonism is and the general ideals behind it. So usually if I would tell someone I was Community of Christ or growing up at the time RLDS, it was, "Oh, well, let me first explain what LDS is, and then here's what RLDS is." And then with the whole name change, it got more complicated trying to explain everything. But I think most people, they kind of view RLDS the same as LDS. They don't really know the difference. So, we have to explain it and just kind of talk about different things with that. But I think growing up, like, having friends or someone I dated who wasn't in the church, it was very cool to explain to them because I was always very excited, and knowing that I had a lot of different friends from a lot of different backgrounds and that I could feel very comfortable inviting them to church and having them join, you know, especially if they had come from some denomination or other area of spirituality where maybe they weren't welcomed or didn't feel comfortable. And I always felt like our doors were open for them.
I think, too, it depends on where in the country you grow up. I don't know how many congregations you had close to you in Kansas City.
A lot.
Yeah.
Lots of congregations.
Yeah. So the closer you get to kind of that area of the country, there's more. Whereas I grew up in Alabama, and we had the one congregation in my city, and it was me and my brother in terms of youth group for a lot of it. And so explaining who we were in such a narrow context where there was really only one congregation that anybody would be driving through Mobile to see was really different. And then explaining it in the South, where it's sort of like the heart of the Bible Belt, and theologically they're very different from Mormons to begin with, and then for us to be associated with LDS kind of movements there was tricky to navigate, to try and talk about who we were and who we weren't and how we were different. I don't know. It was a tricky thing to navigate.
So you never tried not to bring in the LDS?
Well, at first you couldn't help it because that was in the name.
Okay.
I don't know if I ever avoided it on purpose.
No, I don't think I ever avoided it, but I think that people assumed RLDS, since they assumed it was the same or very similar, we had to just kind of step back and be like, oh, there's actually, you know, they're two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more of just trying to, and understanding that as a younger child is not easy.
Especially when the name's a mouthful.
Oh, yeah. We learned songs to learn the name. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you sing the song?
I'll sing it for you. Okay. But you can't judge me on my singing voice.
I don't know if I know this song. So you...
Well, it's not like a song. It was just a tune. It's how I memorized the name, and we would play games in Sunday school so that we could memorize it because it's long for like a, you know, 6-year-old kid to learn about it. But it goes, Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that's how I memorized it.
That's delightful. Yeah. I never learned that jingle.
And Mormon kids learn a very similar song because the name of the LDS church is very long too.
Mm-hmm.
So Jen, you want to sing that one?
I don't know that one.
You don't know that one? I belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm probably messing up the tune because I was a Jack Mormon and never went to Sunday school except for like once. But I remember that tune. So yeah, it's kind of funny that you had to teach the kids the name of the church in both traditions through song.
It starts through the Adams family.
Okay, you have to sing it.
Oh, I don't know
about
singing.
Come on now.
The Organized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for a wonderful family. Da-da-da-da.
That's funny.
I like
that. And I don't know if that would have flown during primary within an LDS ward. I don't think so. That might be a little too secular. Yeah.
Sure.
So as you guys reflect back on your experiences growing up in Community of Christ, what were the things that anchored you in your membership and your identity, really?
A lot of things.
I think, you know, time and time again, when you hear people's stories about their kind of continued perseverance and dedication to Community of Christ, it's always rooted in relationships. You know, at a congregational level, especially if you grow up in a congregation, you know, when you're a little kid, you go to Sunday school, and there are these adults who are kind of part of your earliest formation. And then as you grow up and, you know, come into middle school and then high school, it's that same key group of people. And then as you start to journey out a little bit and, you know, maybe start to have questions theologically or, maybe start to have doubts about the relevance, or the need for a regular congregational life experience in your life. I mean, it's pretty normal as a teenager to show up at a Sunday traditional service and think, what's the point of this? But, the fact that those persons, who were part of that community were still equally dedicated to you, in the sense that, you know, even if you weren't fully committed to being there on a Sunday or something like that, you'd always see those folks at your graduation party, or they'd send you cards on your birthday once you were out at college. And so those foundational relationships of people who, you know, care about you, for me, that was always what kept me the most fully engaged in the church, even if there were points when I felt I was drifting from the actual entity of the church. Those relationships always kept me rooted in it.
I think there's really a lot to be said for a church family. I think that got me through a lot of things just growing up and knowing that I had the support of just friends and family, but in a larger sense, my church family. And having my parents and lots of my family be in Community of Christ, you know, it's always been around me. So there's not really anything else I've known. But my closest friends growing up were in the church, and still to this day, a lot of my closest friends are, church members. And, but I mean, that's how Aaron and I met through like going to Graceland. And, that's made our relationship, I think, no relationship's easy, but like no stress at all when it comes to talking about religion or our belief systems. And I think that one of the things I've always appreciated about that support system that's been there is that there was always a very low pressure environment of, you know, we want to teach you about this, and this is what our church is about and what we believe in. But it was a,
you're able to figure it out on your own too, and kind of come into your own beliefs with things, which I've always really appreciated, that it's never been just stone what it is. You know, obviously there's a set core of beliefs and values and mission initiatives, but I've been able to really adapt my own knowledge and my own beliefs around that too.
I remember when I was a kid, I'll never forget, I was asking my dad, what made our church different? Because a lot of times I would get asked that question when I was a kid. And he said to me, "Emily, we're a thinking church, and that we don't always have the answer, and we're okay with that. And we don't claim to always have the answer." And that is really what laid the groundwork for me to feel okay with having questions and letting myself be unraveled in college and reweave myself back together. So that, I think, fluidity provided the space to stay rooted.
Yeah. When people ask me what's the major difference between the LDS Church and Community of Christ, I often say that Mormonism is very concerned about having the answers, where Community of Christ is about the right questions, or about asking the right questions. And so it's a very different way to approach things. And oftentimes we say, we don't know. Or, A and B are both right, potentially.
Or what do you think?
Or what do you think? Or let's journey with this a while. And that's very different than having a set of doctrines that's very fixed and trying to provide answers for everything.
And for some people, it's hard to go from that. You have an answer for everything. I remember when we were first meeting with an older couple, the Passerettis, when we were investigating the Community of Christ, and we'd say, "Well, what's your answer on like the afterlife or whatever?" And they're like, "Well, I don't know." Like, what?
Answer?
And it was hard to get used to, because I'm like, do they believe in anything? Like, what is it? But once you finally got to the core of it, it really is beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I got to a point where I said, "Oh, the fact you don't have an answer is an answer, and that's okay." So, obviously, we have this identity as Christians. Talk about your experience growing up and your connection with the Restoration, or maybe how the Restoration matters to you today.
I think for me, it comes down to story. So something that I've discovered in my education right now, I'm going to school at Claremont School of Theology, and when I'm engaging in class with Christians from all across the religious spectrum, and, you know, we've got Muslims and Jews and Buddhists all in our classes together too, it's really great. When I engage with them, history and story is different, because for them it stretches way farther back into the past. And because we are such a recent movement, I find myself more attached to our story than maybe even farther back Christian story. And I find myself, you know, drawn to all of it, but there's something very personal about story and history in our movement, and not just like, you know, Joseph Smith the Third story or Emma Smith story, like story of my family or story of Graceland stories. You know, that's rooted me in kind of us as a movement, and the fact that we hold on to continuing revelation. And our story moves forward. Like, that's been what holds me.
Yeah. I think as a kid, as narrow as my full understanding of what it meant to be part of the Restoration was, I definitely felt like I was a part of something special. Knowing some of the story and just, like Emily was talking about, the more recent history of the church that makes it unique, It really made me feel like I was part of something different. And my parents helped to kind of form that in me, but not in an exclusive way, like, well, you know, we're the one true church, because, you know, obviously we've shifted away from that mentality, but more just the sense that, well, you know, we've started writing a story, but that's a story that we very much are still writing. And of course, you know, the continuing revelation and the Doctrine and Covenants wisdom that we're still receiving. And, you know, obviously, Community of Christ is always changing name, changing policy, having new scripture and revelation that shapes how we act in the world as a movement. Those things for me have always been special. And I was at an ecumenical council meeting for Southern California a few days ago, And we were talking about things that are relevant and important for the larger Christian body to talk about today. And there are some things that we're able to talk about as community of Christ because we're so fluid in our willingness to be reshaped by what we're being called as a movement, that we're able to have conversations that other denominations just aren't even able to have because certain things are so rigid structurally that they can't even begin to imagine having a conversation about moving beyond that. But for us, that's just such a natural part of who we are.
It's in our denominational DNA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I really appreciate the adaptability of the church because it's, you know, it's not just at a standstill at any given point. And I think that goes with like a lot of my personal belief systems of, you know, if there's something that's changing, you have to kind of change with it or at least consider that. So I think that's kind of helped me stay engaged, especially with, you know, things that happen in our world today and things that will happen in the future where, you know, 50 years from now, we might be, you know, continuing to go in a completely new direction that we may have never thought of before. So I think that's a huge part of it for me.
And it's something that you're proud of too, you know, the adaptability and the fact that we can, you know, change as the world changes in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and to speak about adaptability, so as all four of you, I don't know if you like the term millennials, but I would say you're millennials, right?
Sure.
I'm okay with it.
All four of you are the first generation of the church to grow up with women in the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And to have that continuously throughout your lives, is that fair?
Oh, yeah.
And so, Jen, you actually had some questions to ask about that earlier, and I thought they were worth lifting up again.
Yeah, so just a background for me, growing up, it was always the men that had the priesthood. So I always wondered, wow, you know, when they give blessings, do they receive some sort of spiritual thing in their head and then they know what to tell people? And it was always just this mystery, right?
Sure.
Because we didn't have anything to do with it. So when it came around, you know, that women could hold the priesthood and you guys have had it in your lives, just how has that affected you? Mm-hmm. And what is it like growing up with that ability?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty normal.
Didn't feel odd or
it didn't
frivolous.
Feel very just, different. Yeah. I mean, I know that one thing that I will say I found special was that my mom was the one who baptized me. And that was just a sweet, intimate thing. And I've seen several baptisms where it's just women. And that has been a really powerful image. So another baptism that's been meaningful to me is I invited my friend to church and she went to camp and she got baptized by our youth leader at that point, Brenda Linfesty, and I got to go in the water with her. So there were just these three women all dressed in white walking into the lake at camp together. And that was a powerful image for me, just as, you know, a young woman seeing God be present in our lives. So that was powerful. At the same time, like, it's always been a normal thing, too. I mean, I was born in 1990, and, you know, we had women in the priesthood for 4 or 5 years at that point. So
so the idea of holding priesthood yourself was something you look forward to, perhaps? Or?
It was never anything that I thought too much about as a possibility for me or not a possibility. Like, it was very neutral. And so...
Yeah.
Being called to priesthood is a different thing, I think. It's not something...
It's not assumed or...
It's not like a looked forward to thing, maybe. Although sometimes it is. I don't know. It's a tricky thing to describe. It's very tricky.
It's kind of a mutual recognition. So I feel like most of the time when a priesthood call is received, it's when somebody has encountered some sort of disruption or the sense of something in their life. And then... You know, around that same time, or maybe a little bit later, as that's really starting to build up, the pastor or leader comes forward and says, you know, let's have a conversation. I'm sensing, you know, a call for you into priesthood ministry, maybe to this specific office. And then, you know, sometimes somebody will say, well, give me some time to think about that. Or they'll just say, I've been feeling exactly that. You know, let's talk about the next step. And I think, you know, just kind of talking specifically about women in the priesthood, in my paradigm growing up, there was never any sort of sense that a man was more likely to be called into the priesthood than a woman, or that a man was more entitled to a certain office than a woman was. And in fact, I can't really speak specifically because I don't remember about who held what offices in the congregation I grew up in, but I felt as though there was stronger women leadership in my congregation than men leadership. There were male leaders, of course, as well, but the people who I really looked up to in my congregation were women. And so then, after being a child, the whole notion of men being more capable leaders than women or any of those sort of things just never made sense to me because that's not what I experienced in my upbringing.
Yeah, I think it wasn't until I was a little bit older that I even thought, oh, that's an issue for people. Because, I mean, both my parents, you know, since I was born, have always been in the priesthood, and I've always had lots of different male and female leaders in the congregations I've been a part of. And so it was kind of shocking for me to hear that that was something that wasn't accepted or something that wasn't a part of different denominations or congregations and whatnot. I think I'm the only one out of us here that isn't ordained currently. And so for me, just even when I was younger, thinking about being called to priesthood, it was never an issue of, is that okay for me as a woman? It was, you know, is that something I'm prepared for as a person? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think for all of us, you know, we've been very fortunate to be at the point in our world where we've seen a lot of equality, and a lot of things going in the right direction, with a lot of things that are, you know, still in progress with that, with so many different issues. So I don't even know how I would have, Emily and I both, I think, are a lot on the same page when it comes to women's rights and how we feel about that. And so I think it would be hard for me to grasp 20 years before I was born, you know, things coming into change with that, and just that being a reality of how things were. And so I think it's been really fortunate, probably for, I'm sure all of us, but specifically Emily and I as women, to grow up with strong female leadership.
Right. I think too, there's this definite reverence that I hold for some of the women that were fighting for that right. And the first women to be called to priesthood in certain areas. Like I find that to be a very special thing. And so I kind of have this tension between it being very normal and like something I don't think about, and then this other part where I really think back and appreciate all of the women who have worked before me. In fact, I remember when I was a Graceland rep, I went to a camp, and the first time I met Chandra Newcomb, I don't know if you guys know her, she's a Colorado Mission Center president now, she sat me down, and she just wanted to talk to me about even just the generation just before me. So she had gone to Graceland, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years before me, I don't know, and she had talked about how when she was called to priesthood, or maybe it was her friend, I'm telling this story really badly, she would serve communion at the chapel, and there were people who wouldn't go to take communion from her. And she just felt this deep need to tell that to me and share that and name that I am sort of, she was just naming how grateful she was that I was able to flourish after that. And so there's a deep reverence, I think, there. Yeah,
and I think it's useful to look back on that. I know it's easy for me to be critical of the church even still, and to have my complaints and my frustrations, but then to hear those kind of stories. And I remember a woman who talked to me about, you know, when she was one of the first in her congregation to receive a priesthood call, and you know, so many men spoke against that, and even women spoke against it, and how her husband disagreed with her priesthood call, and how people refused to take communion from her. And I'm thinking, gosh, get the heck out of this church, you know. But I think it's that willingness to look at the church with all of its imperfections, but still see how it's beautiful, and be willing to take that journey, because you see where it's been and where it's gotten to. And then you can see that glimpse, that vision of the future, and say, you know, even though it's hard right now and we're wrestling, I can see that this is where we're going, and it's worth me sticking with it and being part of that. Mm-hmm. So those stories from the past, you know, we're hearing similar stories today, but for different groups that are oppressed, or for different groups that have misunderstanding in terms of their ministry or their role in the church. And I think it's valuable
take those pieces of history and see how they inform where the church is being led even today.
So, Emily, you're a priest.
I am.
So I was a priest when I was 16 in the LDS Church, but I think there's a big difference between what a priest does in Community of Christ versus my experience. And that's true for all the Aaronic priesthood offices. Growing up with ordination, you know, there were worthiness considerations, but for the most part, it was a matter of gender and age. Those were the primary considerations on why you were ordained. And it culminated, for males, in becoming an elder. So there was a real sense of climbing a ladder, with the Aaronic offices being the lower rungs. So maybe in contrast to that, can you speak to your experience as a priest in Community of Christ and what Aaronic ministers can offer and bring to a congregation?
I was called when I was 17. And that is shocking to me. The idea that my 17-year-old self would hold priesthood is like shocking. So I say that because I have, my priesthood has meant such different things to me as I've grown up that I can't imagine it being limited to age. So that's the one difference. But that an age thing, gosh, I was called in a similar time frame, it sounds like, but it like shocks me. I think it's easy to look at priesthood in a hierarchical way, especially if you come from an LDS tradition, it sounds like. And even in our church, it's been looked at as a hierarchical thing for years and years, and we're moving towards a different appreciation of it. And so for me, I mean, being a priest really is about ministry of presence and being able to be alert to the movement of the Spirit in relationships and families and in congregations, and respond to the promptings that you feel led to do to really nurture those relationships and follow where God is working. And for me, that seems like a really, I mean, high stakes thing. So for it to be viewed as something that is somehow less than, must be hard. I guess I think for me, serving communion is a really powerful experience. Seeing the faces of people as they come up to you and feeling connected in this meal where we are all, taking on Christ as this unifying force in our lives and in our community and agreeing to, make Christ's mission our mission all together and be equal at the table together. Like that's a powerful image. So that's something that's really meaningful to me. I don't know if I'm really answering your question.
No, you are. maybe the rest of you can speak to, just how key the Aaronic priesthood offices are in congregational life and leadership and what you've experienced.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting. So, and I can't say that this is a blanket statement, but this was at least the case for me that when I was called to elder, and elder was the first priesthood office that I was called to when I was 20, and it's the office that I still hold, that for me, that was never really an ego stroking experience. You know, it was never like, well, I've become such a great minister that now it's time for me to be an elder because it's that time for me. And eventually I'll be this, you know, it didn't seem like levels and that I was climbing a ladder. If anything, the priesthood call for me was incredibly humbling. Mm-hmm. And as an elder, one of the sacraments I am able to perform is administration. So it's like a prayer of healing and you bless and anoint with oil. And, the first time I got to participate in that experience, I remember just this overwhelming sense of humility, and this overwhelming, sense of being humbled by God and just thinking, God, it is so amazing that you're willing to work through me in this way to reach others. And so it's not so much about me. It's about, you know, what God is willing to do through me, to to be a, for me to be a vessel, a source of this ministry that's so desperately needed in the world. And that my priesthood is a way to communicate God's love for the world. And so in that sense, it's never been to me, well, I'm an elder, so I have this heightened wisdom or this spiritual depth or awareness that others don't have, but rather just, you know, as somebody who's present in the priesthood, I have this deep calling to open others to how God is working in their lives and what God's trying to do in their lives. That's more just my experience than anything, but it kind of touches on what that priesthood call and what that responsibility has felt like for me.
So I think for me, I was recently ordained a deacon, I think a few months ago now. And like Emily and Daniel have said as well, you know, I never necessarily looked at deacon and said, that's what I want to do. It was more, you know, I'm just doing my part at the church, whatever that means, whatever I can offer. And, you know, the call happened and I was obviously extremely excited and humbled to accept it. And, you know, to get to the hierarchical concept of it, you know, I think a lot of people, unfortunately look at it like that. I think really more it's just helping people, be focused on their strengths and the, you know, the different ways that they can give ministry. So for a deacon as myself, you know, I find myself as, you know, someone that's working to make the congregation a welcoming and a comfortable place for people to worship. And, you know, I'm more of a hands-on, you know, get dirty, knock things out type of guy rather than, you know, the other side of it. And so I really think that's what's been great for me is it really has fit my personality and my strengths. And I think that's what's great about the different offices of the priesthood.
I think it really does. It, there's so much focus that goes on the different strengths that people hold, with how they can impact others that are in the congregation and others who are outside the congregation, or outside the denomination, just with what they can do spiritually. And I think that's played a big role for me on having different people influence me within those different roles, because my role is a member right now. And I think that's such a key role for whether you hold priesthood or not. That's a huge step for me as a young child, you know, becoming a member of the church and, really being able to grow into that with a lot of the influence of other, people around me. And that still has a huge impact on me. I think that the system, for lack of a better word, of everyone in the roles that they have just really helps everything kind of play out so that, everyone is supported and there's just a great environment for everyone.
Well, and I appreciate you lifting that up, Lee, the importance of the office of member and disciple is primary and of paramount importance for everyone in the church, from the very newest member all the way up to the president of the church. At first and foremost, we're all members, and there's very clear duties that are spelled out with that. And to create like a secondary class of people within the church who are priesthood, opposed to the members, goes against the kind of community that Jesus was teaching us that we needed to live in. And so, but I did like, you know, the earlier comment about priesthood is very specialized, and it does help us focus on areas we need to focus on. And so, you know, members and priesthood, disciples and priesthood members all come together to fulfill the mission of Christ, and nobody's more important than anyone else. Now, having said that, Daniel, I wanted to lift up the fact that you're the son of an apostle. Okay. Do you ever get any sort of recognition or special treatment because of that? I mean, we know we talk about, you know, the priesthood being horizontal rather than vertical, and yet, I mean, there's going to be more prominence for somebody who serves in the Council of 12 than, say, your deacon at a local congregation.
Right. Well, I do when I travel around to different places. You know, who are you? I'm Daniel Harmon. They go, oh, are you related to Ron Harmon? And, you know, this part of me always wants to just be like, well, no. Don't know who that guy is. And usually there's a story about my dad or how they know my dad or how important my dad is to them. And it's like, okay, you know, that's cool and all. So hopefully I can do something for you here too. As a person, you know, as Daniel Harmon, not just as the son of Ron Harmon. At the same time, though, there's a, there's not a lot of formality around the fact that my dad is an apostle. So, I mean, in my home mission center, the Kentuckiana Mission Center, at the reunions immediately after he was called to and started serving as an apostle, I mean, the main thing that changed, you know, wasn't how people treated him, but rather that they would make jokes about him being an apostle when we played volleyball and stuff like that. So, I mean, it didn't shift, you know, people's relationship with my dad. I mean, people who knew him as Ron still called him Ron. Hey, Ron, good. People didn't start addressing him as Apostle Harmon or, yeah, you know, Your Excellency or anything, you know, just kind of formal like that. So, you know, it obviously, you know, it's connected me to people in a way because they know my dad. You know, I can say just honestly, it's a little annoying at times, but at the same, but at the same time, you know, my dad isn't thought of as like this, I don't know, almost not fully human, lifted up person that we have to honor and, you know, look up to and go, oh my gosh, that guy. So that's good for me because I don't look at him that way.
So one thing that's been mentioned several times tonight is camping or reunion, mm-hmm, which is unfamiliar for most of our Latter-day Saint listeners. It just isn't part of the experience to have a reunion. So to give a little background, and then I want you guys to talk about your experiences with reunion. Reunion came about when Joseph Smith III decided that there wasn't going to be an October conference. And so one was enough for the year. And the members of the church said, but hey, wait a second, we like getting together twice a year. And he said, well, if you want to get together, you get together on your own dime, basically. So they started camping together. And there's some great photos, early reorganization photos. I guess this is the 1880s. David Hallett can correct me later. But I think it's the 1880s, 1890s that they start to get together. And there's great photos of them camping at Kirtland Temple you know, in tents and just... there's one that I've seen that has a child, a little boy about the age of our little boy, Jen and I, about 3 years old, and he has this wooden rocking horse that he's brought with him. And you figure they had to put that in a wagon and take it all the way there, but they were going to be there all week, maybe longer. Mm-hmm. And so the kid needed something to play with. It's just such, you know, think about the kinds of things that, you know, they would have had to pack and all the preparations that went into that. And then all the way to the experience that we have today with camping and community of Christ. So how important was reunion to you growing up? How important is it now? And tell us about your experiences.
Oh, man.
Who first?
Okay, I'll start.
Do it.
Camping, regardless of what camp it was at, because I attended usually more than one throughout each summer, since I can remember, has been like, I think one of the biggest things that have really resonated within my experience as a Community of Christ member. My parents, a lot of my family I already mentioned, come from the church. And so it was just a thing we did every summer. Me, my mom, my dad, and my brother would go up and just have the greatest time worshiping, just congregating with everybody, you know, playing in the pool, doing campfires at night. Everything was just, it is so fantastic about the experience. And I think going to camp is really what kind of helped me come into my spirituality. It was really important to me when I turned 8 that I was going to be baptized on the campgrounds that I knew and loved so much. So I waited 4 months, which was really hard for me because my birthday's in February. So I waited until like July to get baptized. And so that was like a really long time because most people were super excited and, you know, it's my 8th birthday. I'm getting baptized tomorrow. but I waited it out and I went to that really sacred place for me.
And our daughter did the exact same thing. So from January too. To July, just this last summer, got baptized at camp because it was so important to her.
I can remember so much of that day. And I don't think I could tell you anything else about my 8-year-old life. But that day stands out a lot in my memory. And just, you know, since I started going to like youth camps outside of reunion, I did junior camp, which you start, I think, in 3rd grade. And I did junior high camp and senior high camp. And so between those and reunions and going to Spectacular at Graceland, I had formed, and I grew up in the church with my very best friend, who's still my best friend today. So we've been best friends since we like couldn't talk.
And so we had this strong bond, and we formed this group of friends that we only saw each other once a year at camp. And so that was the biggest thing for all of us during the year, was that we're so excited to get together. And then leaving was like the worst thing ever. So as someone who was 18, finishing their last senior high camp and probably the last reunion that I would regularly attend with my family before I went off to college, that was terrible to leave behind, because that was what I was all about. Whether I was there during the week or the weeks leading up to it during the year, is a huge, huge part of my youth and growing up.
So you mentioned that you sometimes went to several camps during the summer, which is the first thing I ran into this summer when we were at Brush Creek. We had a family we knew from Nashville, and they mentioned having gone to like 2 camps already that summer in that third. Mm-hmm. So I'd never heard that before either. That you could go to multiple camps throughout the whole summer.
And some people are crazy about it. Like, they'll go, growing up in Kansas City, there's multiple campgrounds, like, right around us. The one I always went to was Chihuahua out in Perry, Kansas. And, so there's a couple others that I have been to, but that was the one I went to every single year. So we would have at least 1 week of reunion, at least 1 week of youth camp. And then a lot of people would go to the other reunions too, because most of the time they're never during the same week. So you could fill a whole summer. And, you know, with my parents being very involved in the church, both very musical, a lot of the times they were guest minister or guest musicians at different camps. So it was a great family experience, a great friendship experience for me, and really solidified me with my time in the church.
Yeah. I think I can echo that. It definitely solidified me. My family, we went to reunion more sporadically than we did like youth camps, particularly because my parents were generally on staff at the youth camps. And so it was just kind of how much camp we could put into a summer. And so that, I mean, it solidified me in that I formed a network of friends that we had encountered God together. And that was just extremely valuable. And they were people that, like Lee said, you know, you don't see except for at these kind of experiences together. And you kept in contact throughout the year, and they rooted you. I also think I was really lucky because I, got to be a Graceland rep, which is a very denominationally specific term, but you can get paid as a Graceland student to spend your summer going to camps all over the country. And I went to Canada actually as well, for the whole summer, and get to be a camp counselor and just encounter the church all over the place. And it's remarkable how similar camp is all over the place. And it's remarkable how very specific camp is. So, one thing that happens at camp is campfire. And that's also another really denominationally specific thing I'm finding. But we sing silly songs, and then we sing like transitional kind of songs, and then we sing more sacred spiritual songs that are in this like unsaid, written, memorized canon that we've just sort of all carried along. And songs are sung the same way across the country, and some of them are very specifically not the same way. And if you sing it the wrong way when you're leading the campfire, the kids will tell you that you're singing it the wrong way. So it was just a fabulous experience to go across the country and not only tell people about Graceland and the wonderful college experience that is, but to really immerse yourself in their camp community as a place that's so special to them. It was a treat.
Oh, yeah. Well, and if you want to talk about like traditions and community of Christ, I mean, there are some strong traditions like at the congregational level, but you know, if you want to see traditions that people are like, you know, over my dead body, are you going to change that? Go to a community of Christ reunion. Every single one will have at least a couple things.
A couple things that never change.
If you challenge, why exactly do you do this? You know, it's like, oh my gosh, like you can't ask that question. So that's interesting tidbit about our camping. Yes. You know, it's probably, I think, where some of our strongest traditions lie.
Yeah.
Some of which are universal, like campfire. Some of them which are very geographically campground specific.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So tell us about campfire dates.
Which campfire date?
Well, the reason this came up is because Jen had mentioned that camps were different in the LDS church, right? There's like
youth camps,
yeah. Right? So there's like young women's camp and young men's camp.
Is separated, yeah.
Right. And so my first comment was, well, that makes campfire dates really tricky.
For some.
For some, right? Yeah, maybe not for others. But yeah, that's it. It seems like it's a geographically broad thing. We all knew what that was. That yeah. was an experience and across the board.
You know, what's kind of funny is when we started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, that was a thing. Like, I'm remembering back like all the awkward moments of like either someone who you wanted to ask, you, from my perspective, usually someone else asked me, I wasn't brave enough to go ask somebody, sure. but you know, there was somebody that I grew up dating that he was kind of my campfire date all the time. And then someone else would ask and I'd be like, I'm really bad at telling people no with stuff like that. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'll go with you. And mm-hmm. it was, like, as soon as you were going with somebody, I think everybody knew about it.
Yeah.
And oh, so for sure. it was like the gossip of
it was,
town.
It was the bedrock of yeah. Graceland dating is really what it
Yeah. It really gave us a good introduction into Graceland dating, which we can talk about
for a long time. Oh, yeah.
Well, at a lot of camps. So some camps are bigger, but some are smaller. So, like, that would be my camp, where maybe in terms of my age bracket of people who I could go on campfire dates with, there's maybe a handful. And then there's a handful on the other side. So if we're talking about male-female, which it predominantly was in my campgrounds. And so it was me and my group of guy friends, and then there's this group of girls. And it was like, we just kind of weave around each other. So go on dates with different girls throughout the same week, or, you know, we trade off year to year.
And it was, yeah, we kind of did
just
that kind too.
And it was strange how there wasn't really any awkwardness about that. Cause it's like, well, you know, what else are we going to do? And the other interesting thing about a campfire date, it's not like that really means anything other than that you sit by that person.
Yeah, that was it.
So you don't, it's not like.
You might hold hands.
We're dates, maybe. Yeah. It's not like anything.
If it's dark enough, right?
Yeah. Nothing like truly romantic or provocative right. happens. It's just like, well, we're going to sit next to each other in the right. campfire date. And then half the time it's like, all right, we'll see ya. Thanks for that date.
One of my very favorite campfire dates was when I was probably junior high and my dad was the director. And so he decided to send two staff members to sit on either side of us to whisper across us and say, Emily's at campfire with a boy over and over. That was a lot of fun. Thanks, Dad.
So I want to end talking about Graceland and your experiences there.
Oh, man.
Tell us, let me tell a story, I guess. I have a friend who was at Graceland and noticed in one of the bathrooms somebody had scribbled out graffiti that said BYU sucks. What's really funny is that there is nobody at BYU that even knows what Graceland is. You know what I mean? So like to have this like rivalry, pretended rivalry as Community of Christ school sure. against BYU. But anyway, our listeners for the most part won't know what Graceland is. So,
right.
so give them a background, you know, to it and your experiences oh, there and how start? Important it was.
Do you have a second podcast for that?
I was going to say, first, a little clarifying point. I think that rivalry, I think that one person who wrote that might be the only person who that exists
yeah.
for.
Yeah, because we don't that consider that at all.
Silly. Maybe 1% of the Graceland no. student body is aware that Brigham Young, you know, is really the
yeah, and you know that's
what that BYU even exists.
That's yeah. what's interesting about the current Graceland population is if you looked at it 30, 40 years ago, it is RLDS/Community of Christ. That's what Graceland
like
was.
95%.
Yeah. Now it's. I would say probably less than 50%.
Oh yeah, 30% ish.
Yeah, just because there's so much recruiting that goes on with sports, and you know what's great about it is that yes, it's affiliated with the church, but you're not required to be a member to attend right. college there, and it's a very welcoming place. And I oh, thought yeah. one of the coolest parts of my experience was learning about other faiths
for sure.
from different people and what they believe.
As a college, our admissions like lights are lighting up right now because
yeah,
we all worked in admissions, but as a college, we had the highest concentration, like percentage wise, of international students.
I think in Iowa. It's 17%.
I think it's 17%.
Which is crazy.
Crazy
for
high.
For a tiny liberal arts school in yeah. southern Iowa.
Right. And so the diversity on campus was just fabulous. And as a result, we did have the opportunity to learn about more than just Community of Christ. I remember one night, for Wednesday night church in the chapel, we had a night where we talked to our Muslim friends about their faith and they were able to tell us about their experience.
And that's really fascinating too when you consider the name of the town that it's in is Lamoni.
Named
after a Book of Mormon figure.
Right.
And the town itself was founded as part of a United Order.
Yeah.
And so I don't think a lot of Mormons know that. Yeah. I mean, so there's so much church history there and restoration connections, mm-hmm. and then it's a church school to begin mm-hmm. with, you know, and then today to see the diversity that's there, it's really fascinating.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we could talk for days about our experience at Graceland, for sure.
I was just going to say, do you have to have an ecclesiastical endorsement to go to Graceland? Do you have to go talk to your pastor and sign off on worthiness issues? And-
Oh, my gosh. What is that?
I don't even know what that means.
What are you saying right now?
I'm just curious. I had to do something. I'm a graduate of LDS Business College, and you do have to have an ecclesiastical endorsement. And if you... you know, fail to keep that up, you could potentially be kicked out of the school.
What is that? What do you mean by ecclesiastical endorsement?
Like the bishop has to sign off and say, yeah, this person keeps the word of wisdom and the law of chastity and pays their tithing and goes to church and...
Maybe we should talk about...
Emily's expression right now.
We are begging our youth to go to Graceland.
Maybe we should talk about standards for... for admission and retention at Graceland.
Hey, you should probably cut that section.
Yeah, get rid of it.
I think the thing with Graceland, spirituality is a huge part of my life, and it's something that I continue to develop and continue to question and continue to learn about. And for me, Graceland was kind of a shocking reality getting there, because I went up, we had this pact, my group of friends, my church friends. We were all going to go to Graceland together, and we're all going to be best friends for life. And we got and we all separated.
Oh.
And not in a bad way. Like, I still love those people very much, and a few of them I am still very close with. But it wasn't all of a sudden, it wasn't all about church anymore. And it wasn't all about the church camps that we have. And it was mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, we're at college, and there's all these other things that are going on, and we're meeting new people, and just having more and more diversity put into our lives. And so, for me, going to Graceland was a very different experience than I thought it would be. And, I think I grew a lot there, but it became a lot more broad than I think I was a little bit more close-minded with a lot of different things. And I learned a lot more. I met lifelong friends, and I met my husband, and he did really, that's totally another Graceland topic we could get on too, is like,
I mean, meeting your spouse at Graceland.
Ring by spring.
By spring.
Yeah. All, yeah.
Spring, I mean, by spring.
Ring by spring.
Ring by spring.
Spring.
Ring by
yeah.
Spring.
That's a big thing. And, you know, it's a weird phenomena that Graceland has where you go there and you're immediately all of a sudden the other half of a couple. Out of nowhere, it's like, oh, and now we're married. Okay. When did that happen?
Well, you grow up hearing stories.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, our parents met at Graceland. Your parents met at Graceland.
You know, actually.
His, yeah. So, it's inherited stories that we all kind of carry. And it's hard if your story doesn't match that, too. Like, we sort of fell into that stereotype, but... my brother didn't fall into that stereotype. Daniel's youngest sister didn't do that. And so it's like, it's different.
And it's like, I think it's something that's in our strange little community of Christ DNA, because parents actually didn't even overlap each other at Graceland. And they met on a blind date through a mutual friend. And so they had like two, I know it's really random. They had two totally different experiences, but, like, how did they still get connected? And then learning, like, there's different connections. Like, you know, your parents' cousin knows my mom's ex-wife. my mom's ex-husband or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, it's his dad dated my mom's roommate in college. And so that's one of the things you have to do when you get to Grace, is just make sure you're not cousins with anybody.
Yeah. I had a list of last names.
Oh, yeah.
Don't say these last names when you go to Graceland.
Yeah.
So another piece of all that is... this desire, because Graceland, I mean, I know for every one of us sitting on this couch, was so foundational to who we are, and those are stories we'll always treasure. Such an important part of, you know, our own discovery and growth. But I literally had friends who, you know, as they were near graduation, you know, didn't have a relationship, a boyfriend, girlfriend, a fiance. And, you know, they'd talk about dating outside of Graceland and say, I don't know if I can marry somebody who didn't go to Graceland.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's a legitimate thing.
I don't know if I can be with somebody who doesn't fully understand that part of my life.
Yeah.
It's just that huge. Yeah. I mean, and
absolutely.
That's a huge thing that I think everyone talks about Graceland, and it's something that's really promoted is the Graceland experience. I did not go, I don't know if I want to say this, I didn't go there for academics. My degree is great, whatever. I did get a degree there, but I could care less if I went to class every day. That sounds bad, but really it's true because the experience and the people and the impact that that had on me, including academics, you know, obviously that was a great impact, but that's not why I was there. Yeah. I was there because that was, I loved being there and it was a life-changing experience for me that I think will continue to have a huge impact as I grow older.
Yeah.
Well, can we close with this? Every time I meet somebody from Graceland, they usually want to tell me about what house they belong to and I have no idea what they're talking about.
It's very Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very... Harry Potter.
So there's no fraternities or sororities there, right? But you have houses.
We do. Mm-hmm.
Explain this.
Well, the first thing you know is that Clausen is the best men's house.
Oh, whatever.
Or Agape, if, you know, you're intelligent, but...
So Clausen, Agape, these are all houses.
Yeah. My dad was on Agape. Yeah.
Aaron was a house president, and so was Lee, actually, so they should explain the house system.
Okay, so the house system is really great because essentially I would describe it as a fraternity or sorority. You don't have to pledge it. You're just automatically welcomed and automatically accepted.
Automatically part of the family.
Automatically part of your little family of, you know, 40 to 50 people that you get to do events with and you get to mingle with other houses and compete in games and, you know, do fun events and functions that are just, they're just so much fun. Everything, it's a huge involvement because then you're not just there to just go to college. Obviously, that's a huge part of it, but it just makes the experience.
Well, college is so hard on everyone. So right when you get there, you automatically have 40 new friends that are going to go through the same exact thing with you. And friends that you're still friends with now.
I still stay
in contact with all my friends from the hall. And I think it's because of that automatic, you know, just interaction with everyone.
Is it based on where you live? Or do you
it's based on the hall that you live on.
You can choose if you want.
You can request.
But
do they put a hat on your head?
No, I wish.
Honestly, a lot of it goes back to the whole family thing. I was on Clausen because my two older brothers were on Clausen. Right.
I requested my house, which was Sala, because I knew a girl that was already there. Yeah. And I was like, I know one person, I'm going there.
Yeah, I was on Shalom because I had already chosen my roommate and her mom was on Shalom and my mom was on Paloma. And so we just decided to go with Shalom. Yeah. Paloma's another woman's house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I requested my house because guys that I grew up going to camp with and looking up to were on that house. So for me, that was just obvious. It's what you do.
Yeah.
And there's just like such a culture of friendship and really it becomes a little family. Like
it does.
One of our things on our house was, Sala's sisters. And I still feel like a lot of those women are, I never had a sister growing up. So I had a family with a bunch of sisters all of a sudden. And that really impacted my experience a lot.
Yeah. You have a meeting once a week with your house and particularly with women's houses, there's a lot of intimacy there. We share joys and concerns about our experience. We tell embarrassing stories in ours. I don't know what you guys do in yours, but they're fun.
Guys, I don't know if the guys
are a little less intimate.
not appropriate for podcasts.
A little bit more
rambunctious. You don't want to record it for posterity.
No.
I don't want to get Graceland
closed down.
All
these former Graceland reps here.
No, just a little more rowdy atmosphere in the guys' house meetings, I'd say. Yeah. Still safe space, but higher energy.
Right.
Yeah. We'll leave it at that.
Well, at that, Daniel, will you play something for us as we close out the podcast?
Yeah, I almost feel like I should sing the Graceland alma mater or something. how does it even, what is, I don't how does know it even the start, the Grace alma mater? I'll just play some random music. This obviously isn't.
Expressed in this podcast are the opinions of those speaking and do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or official stance of Community of Christ or the Latter-day Seekers team.